The Feel Better Station for Warrington Hospital.
This is Radio General.
Now, the final hooter.
It certainly is time for the final hooter. Welcome for the final time in 2017 to the final hooter, which is our look at the rugby league scene here on Radio General through the wards of Warrington Hospital and also through Halton Hospital as well. We also act as the podcast for loverugbyleague.com, and if you're tuning in for the first time, where have you been all season? It's been a real exciting one. I'm Dave Parkinson, I'm your host, and what are we going to go through this evening? Well, of course, it was the big World Cup final, so I'll be looking over that in some detail, give me a couple of minutes on that, and I'll also be looking at what happened in the Women's World Cup final. We'll have a full roundup of who won what, where and when. In this past season, I'm delighted to have you along for the ride. Okay, Saturday morning brought England in a World Cup final, a Rugby League World Cup final, for the first time in 22 years. They came up against their arch nemesis Australia, and this was a really close, tense, tight tussle. It was like turning the clock back to the World Cup final in 1992, and going back even further to the one in 1977, when there was very few points scored and very little between the two sides. A look at the final score, Australia 6, England 0, suggests that not a lot happened. However, you couldn't be further from the truth. Those of you who are regular listeners know that I like my stats, and Australia, they made almost 1,700 metres in the game. Now, they have been getting over 1,500 every single game this World Cup, and this one was no different, to be honest. All their approach play, perfect. You look amongst the back line, so the back five from full-back, including both wingers and both centres, they made almost 800 metres alone from 93 carries. Now, England had a similar sort of success rate, actually. They ran for about 654 metres, I think I added up, amongst their back line. Again, there was very little between the carries amongst the back line. There is an old saying in rugby league that it's the forwards who win you the games and the backs who determine by how many. I'm disagreeing with that a little bit in the modern game because, I don't know, I think backlines tend to get hold of the ball a heck of a lot more. There's a lot more emphasis on kick returns, for example, so it means your wingers and your fullbacks tend to be up there with most meter makers, where once upon a time it would have been your middlemen, it would have been your props, it would have been those guys that really wanted to roll over the top of people, get quick, play the balls, and everything would be channeled through that dummy half play. I think we still play a version of that here in England, to be honest, where we like to take plays back into the ruck. And what I mean by that is it's that little gap in behind the markers. We target it. And if we get in that area to good effect, so players like Chris Hill, for example, runs perfectly into that spot. Burgess was doing it particularly well in this game. Then we tend to make metres and tend to get forward. However, taking all the technicals aside, Australia, they just had enough guts. It was a really gutsy performance from England. I mean, I look at the stats, 388 tackles made by England, 390 by the Australians, only 38 missed tackles from England, 28 missed tackles for Australia. 197 carries for England, 207 carries for Australia. But as I've mentioned, Australia ran for nearly 1,700 metres. England, just less than 1,500, which isn't to be sniffed at. That's not poor by any stretch of the imagination. Again, there were some really determined, strong efforts. I'm looking at Chris Hill from Warrington, 11 carries, 110 metres in the front row. James Graham, he did everything that he could to win that game. 38 tackles, 14 carries, 95 metres. James Roby, 56 tackles, 7 carries, 50 metres and a break. And then you're also looking into the back row. Sam Burgess, 12 carries, 96 metres. Elliot Whitehead, 55 tackles. They were heroes right across the park, to be honest, as far as England were concerned. But ultimately, it came down to what they did with the ball in crucial areas. And don't get me wrong, they held Australia out. And if you look at the first half stats in particular, Australia, they were so dominant. They got on the front foot, scored after 15 minutes when Boyd Cordner just cut back to an outside track and got on the outside shoulder of Kevin Brown and got past him for the try. That was goaled by Smith. So 6 points to nil it was at that stage. And as I've been telling people throughout this World Cup, various things tend to happen in my life. So I sit down, cup of tea, breakfast, World Cup on the telly. Final. I'm thinking, yeah, great. It's going ahead. It's going great guns. I'm going to really, really enjoy this. So we get to about 12, 14 minutes in and the doorbell goes. I gets up and it's a bloke from a certain delivery company delivering a parcel. So I takes the parcel off him, goes back to take my seat, and I've missed the try scored by Boyd Cordner. So I watched the replay, wound the telly back, like you can do these days with the rewind button, watched it again, saw what happened, saw that Cordner got over the top of Kevin Brown. Goal was kicked. I'm thinking, right, I won't miss any more of this. So by the time I'd sort of exited and gone back to where play was up to, they were just at the start of the kickoff again. So I watched it then, no interruptions for the rest of the game. And how was I to know there was only going to be the one try scored? But to be fair, Australia were all over England in the first particular 20 minutes of the game. At that particular point, it could have been 12, it could have been 18 points to nil. So England defended really stoutly, really strongly in that period of time, did particularly well to hold Australia at bay. As I mentioned, England did have some good performances themselves on the bench. Tom Burgess came on and really added some impetus through the middle. England were, of course, missing skipper Sean O'Loughlin. But I've already said I'm not too sure whether, as a player, his stats actually stack up to international standard anymore. But I was having a conversation with somebody outside my local supermarket, actually, the other day. And he was saying, well, as much as he doesn't like to admit it because he's a St. Helens fan, O'Loughlin really adds that extra maybe 10% that's needed to the England setup, because what he tends to do, he tends to coach players through the game. And there's not a lot of players that can have that great an influence, particularly over here in the UK. So maybe that was missed. You look at the stats though, and still to get, you know, nearly 1500 metres suggests that it wasn't. For me, the major difference comes at halfback. I've been saying it for ages. We don't seem to have, or seem to allow, our halfbacks at international level to dictate the game, to actually grab hold of the game by the scruff of the neck. I've got another opinion as well, in the fact that I don't feel we've got enough quality English halfbacks which are playing right in the top level of English rugby league at this moment in time. I don't know the reason behind that. We've produced enough down the years. You look at Sam Tompkins, started off as a halfback, now a fullback, of course. You look at Gaz O'Brien coming through at Warrington a few years ago. Again, really highly rated, but has ended up moving to become a fullback. You've got Sam Powell over at Wigan. Again, an excellent junior halfback, and he's ended up making his mark more of a hooker. So we seem to get these players coming through, and then we move them about and they don't play in the same positions. So it's very difficult when it comes to World Cups and it comes to representative rugby to get players that have played a lot of sufficient rugby in those positions. I mean, even when you look at this halfback pairing that played in this World Cup final, Kevin Brown's had an average season for Warrington. It's not been great, has he? He's had the occasional game where he's been a real thorn in certain sides, but he's not been on fire, has he? And I look at his stats. He only took the ball into contact 3 times in the entire time that he was on the field. So what was he doing? Was he passing the ball? Well, according to these stats, he only had the ball in his hands a further 12 times that he passed it. So he was something of a passenger, really, I think, in that number 6 role for England. Personally, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of George Williams in this tournament. Obviously, Wayne Bennett had other ideas regarding that particular kid, but I hope that he doesn't take it to heart. We've seen a good look now at Luke Gayle, and Luke Gayle is a fantastic club player. He has done particularly well. When you consider that at the age of 18, he was released at Leeds, ended up making his mark at Doncaster first of all, then moving to Harlequins, and he's done it the hard way, hasn't he? He's gone to Bradford, he's then landed in at Castleford, and Castleford seems to be where his game has really took off. Again, unfortunately, we didn't see too much of it in this international level. I would like to see him be able to take the ball up a little bit more than he has been doing. Again, compared with Kevin Brown, Luke Gayle took the ball in 6 times in this game, ran for 26 metres. Now, if I compare that with the Australian halfback pairing of Michael Morgan and Cooper Cronk. Cronk, really another player that isn't particularly noted for his running style, but he made 41 metres, took the ball into contact 7 times, kicked the ball 18 times, passed it 26 times. I'm looking at the stats again from Luke Gayle. He kicked it 20 times, he got his hands on the ball 47 times to pass it. So he was getting a lot of touches, but was he really creating anything with it? And I guess that is where the crux of the matter is. For Australia, Michael Morgan impressed once again. 10 carries, 84 metres, a clean break, and, a try disallowed as well for him. 2 kicks and 33 passes, so he was never that far away from the action. But for me, you can't look beyond Cameron Smith as the main go-to man for Australia. He handled the ball as hooker 138 times, he kicked it 8 times, he made 47 tackles to top the Australia tackle count, and he's just won the Golden Boot. So again, a fantastic, superb, brilliant player, to be honest, is Cameron Smith. And Australia just edging England on the scoreboard, but dominating in the first half. In the second half, England put a lot more pressure on Australia. I think they had maybe 8 or 9 times to have a go at the Australian line, and each and every time Australia defended it. There was, however, a real crucial reactionary tackle and ankle tap from Josh Dugan when he somehow managed to chase back and just tap the ankle of Callum Watkins. Watkins had just zipped up into top gear. He was gone. Had that touch not taken place, I feel confident that Callum Watkins would have scored. At that point, it would have been 6-4 headed into the last 15 minutes, and that would have been a very, very different game. But as it was, Australia, they did dominate, particularly in that first half. Had to rein it in and really defend their line particularly well in the second half, but ultimately they just edged it and did deserve to be world champions.
Radio General.
Did you know that you can listen to Radio General from your mobile device on the internet? Well, tune in at radiogeneral.co.uk. Click the Listen Live link and enjoy Radio General away from your bed. Listen everywhere at radiogeneral.co.uk.
The Feel Better Station for Warrington Hospital.
This is Radio General.
Now, the final hooter.
Okay, so the Kangaroos rule the world again. Yes, again. I'm getting fed up of those pesky Kangaroos keep winning these Rugby League World Cups. But they are a great side. Without a doubt, they are a really, really good side. They've just got some top players right across the board. You look at the back line, Billy Slater still doing his stuff at 34. Dane Gagai was industrious throughout that World Cup final, made 25 carries. On the other wing, Valentine Holmes has been something of a revelation. I talked last week about him scoring 11 tries in the World Cup to overtake, I think it was Wendell Saylor that he overtook at the top of the World Cup try scoring charts for tries in a particular tournament. I've also mentioned I've been very impressed with Michael Morgan in the front row. Big fellas like David Clemmer have stood up. Matt Gillette has been excellent in the back row, and we mentioned Boyd Cordner, having a super tournament as well. Let me have a look at a little bit more detail though at the England squad that has taken this World Cup. I was going to say by storm. And I don't know whether that's the right description or not. Looking at the squad, you look and there's some players that have been sadly underutilised for me. In this entire squad, you've got Chris Hyington only playing in half the games. Johnny Lomax, I know he's been injured, but he only made two appearances in the World Cup. Jermaine McGilvery was an ever-present, but then you've got the likes of Mike McMeekin, who was overlooked for the rest of the tournament. And I don't understand why. He's been the form back rower in Super League all year. Matt Percival goes across as a strike centre, a man that's been in super form, ball in hand for St Helens, and only plays one game on tour. And one game in the warm-ups. And I don't understand it. I don't get it. What was the point in picking him in the first place? Stephen Ratchford again becomes the forgotten man of the international setup, having not been able to push his way through either half-back or full-back. When we're struggling for a dedicated half-back. Okay, Gareth Widdop has had a great tournament. I've been impressed with him this time. And I have to admit that over the recent past, he's never particularly impressed me when it's come to international selections, Gareth Widdop, but I think he's stood up and I think he's had a really solid World Cup. He's actually played his best rugby when he's been back at fullback. He really did fill a slot there for England and kind of fit in. He's not the paciest of players, but he can motor through a gap and get things going. But I think it's more his vision that you want, and that little pass that he does out the back, which he made look so simple for outside backs. Again, very dangerous when coming in. So Scott Taylor as well was another man that was almost forgotten about during this World Cup. What was the point in taking him? And then, of course, George Williams, who I've said before, I would have given him far more game time, if I'm being honest. He is the top creative player in Super League this season. 29 try assists on Wayne Bennett. Puts him on the bench for a couple of games and then leaves him out for the rest of the tournament. I don't understand it. I just don't understand it at all. When you look at other guys that have regularly got in who, you know, Ben Curry, take nothing away from Ben, great player, love him to bits, the way that he runs those lines, he's very dangerous. I think he would have been a better option in the centre rather than Bateman. If you were going to go with a second rower in at centre, then for me, that's the change that I would have made. Bateman to go into the second row and Ben Curry to slot into that position, because I just think Ben Curry offers that bit more on attack. I think that he's a bit more cleverer with the ball. I think he can draw a man, he can put a pass out. He's quite deceptive in his running style and he's quite pacey as well, isn't he, for a rangy fella. So I guess, again, I would like to have seen a little bit more of him. Chris Hyington, well, I had my suspicions before the start of the tournament, to be honest. This is a 35-year-old Australian. What was he doing in the tournament anyway? But he ended up playing in half the games. But I don't get the fact that you take Mike McMeekin, who's been top second rower in Super League all the way through this year, and Matt Percival, who's arguably been the centre of the year in Super League, and you just don't play him. What is Wayne Bennett thinking? Will he actually get another contract at the top job, Wayne Bennett? Do you think he deserves one? Okay, he's got England into a World Cup final. They've been very, very competitive, but for maybe a little bit smarter options, could have won the game in the second half with a bit of an onslaught, but has he done enough in your eyes? Would you recontract him with the knowledge that you've got New Zealand coming over next season? And that is a really good piece of news, by the way, and well done to the Rugby League and the International Federation for announcing the fact that it's New Zealand that's going to be coming over touring next season. And we could have Great Britain back on the agenda again in 2019 when there is the potential of a Pacific tour. And I think that would be superb, because I think both Fiji and Tonga have really grown in this tournament. Fiji did really well in the last tournament in 2013. I think they've upped their efforts again this time. And Tonga was exemplary in honesty. And I feel that they really do need to be playing far more rugby than they're getting given. So we need tours. We need tours happening. We need them playing more rugby. We need them testing themselves against the best. And if Australia don't believe in or only believe in coming together for the World Cups, then why don't we get maybe Queensland and New South Wales playing? They could actually do a representative job in playing both of those countries. I think that could work wonders, to be honest. You know, mid-season, before the state of origin, maybe the warm-up where there was always city v country, maybe we could chuck an international in there between Fiji and Tonga, or even get them to play Queensland and New South Wales and see what happens. I just think it's something a bit different. We should be looking more at growing this game now. We've had two World Cups that have been relatively successful. I know I've been a little bit critical, to be honest, of the crowds and some of the crowds that have been announced over in Australia. But they've generally been pretty good. I mean, there was 40,000 at the World Cup final. You know, you can't sniff at that. That was a good attendance, really. And I think that certainly there's a lot of lessons that have been learned from maybe the 2000 World Cup, which saw so much money lost, and even 2008 as well, where it wasn't particularly well followed, I don't think, when it was down under. I think there has been a lot of lessons learned, and they always say, though, that as long as you can learn from any mistakes that you make, then you're in the right frame, aren't you, and you're stepping forward. Now, I also want to talk a little bit about the Women's World Cup as well, because we've had disappointment as far as England are concerned in that tournament. Yes, they made it through to the semi-finals, but they played the three pool games. They only won the first game, lost the other two, lost heavily to Australia, and then had a shock defeat to the Cook Islands ladies. And, well, the final of the Women's World Cup was a really good game. In fairness, a really good game, and I think that obviously the way that women's sport is developing, that could go a long way as well. It finished the Australia Gillaroos 23, the New Zealand Kiwi Ferns 16, but it was really worthy of it. You saw Australia just edge the game 12-10 at half time, thanks to tries from Kelly and Moran for Australia, and for Hiremi scoring twice for the New Zealand side. Into the second half, then Kelly doubles her try tally and Walton goes over after 57 minutes. New Zealand then puts so much pressure on. McGregor goes over 11 minutes from time to close the gap. Natty nudges over the goal. So at that stage, it's 22 points to 16. The game is on a knife edge. There's chances both sides, both ends. You have New Zealand having a try disallowed. And then right in the very last minute, Moran, who'd kicked three goals, Caitlin Moran, the Australia number seven, who'd kicked three goals earlier in the game, drops a crucial drop goal to make it 23 points to 16. But again, a good tournament that, and Australia being deserving winners in the end. And interestingly enough, Tony Benson has been coaching the New Zealand side, and he said after the game, "I thought we brought a game that could be successful, but we didn't get enough possession. I think it's a fair call to say that we were the better team in the first half, but we weren't smart. Australia played a very safe game, and us being Kiwis, we tended to play like Kiwis. The result shows we need to be smarter at certain stages in the match." And from an Australian point of view, here was what their coach Brad Donald had to say. "It's a cross between relief and a great amount of satisfaction," said Donald. "We knew it was going to come down to how badly we wanted it, not how we were catching and passing the ball. You could see how much it meant to the girls and also to their families. They've sacrificed so much over the past 4 years and they deserve all the plaudits." Interestingly enough, I noticed that the NRL is starting to now talk about introducing a women's league in Australia. We've already got a Super League women's league being set up. You've got likes of Widnes, St Helens, Wigan, Leeds, Castleford have said that they're going forward with teams. And interestingly enough as well, from the respect of that Leeds lineup, they've appointed their first team star, Adam Cuthbertson, as the ladies' coach. And I think that's going to be interesting to see how he goes. I wonder whether he's got actual long-term plans of going into coaching and this is just the first step. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating when you look at the way that this has gone. So ultimately, Australia rule the world in rugby league for both the men's and the women's. We're going to have to wait 4 years to have another crack at them properly. Will we do it next time? Well, I suppose there won't be any Cameron Smith there next time round. There won't be any Cooper Cronk. He'll go have packed up. Jonathan Thurston will probably have gone as well, and even though I know he's been injured for this tournament. So do they have a chance? Well, we'll just have to wait and see just what stars the Australians are uncovering and who will play in the next World Cup.
The Feel Better Station for Warrington Hospital.
This is Radio General.
Now, the final hooter.
Yes, so we've talked Women's Rugby League, we've talked the Men's World Cup Final, we've even talked a little bit about how, in my opinion, certain members of this World Cup squad have been underutilised. What have we got coming up for the rest of the show? Well, I read an interesting little article, actually, in this week's League Express, which was saying about how a piece of land has been granted to Jason Tormalolo. Now, this is the guy that defected from the Kiwis before the start of the World Cup, said he was going to lead Tonga. And to be honest, for me, he's been the best forward in this entire tournament. And yeah, so this is the story. So Tonga World Cup stars Jason Tomalolo and Tuimoala Lolahia have been given parcels of land in Tonga for their roles in the Rugby League World Cup. I think that's a great story, that. The Tonga World Cup stars Jason Tomalolo and Tuimoala Lolahia both being given pieces of land by the nobles of the villages of their parents. I think it's just stories like that which really sum up rugby league and keep it real, I suppose, as far as I'm concerned. As the sun sets upon the 2017 season, it would be remiss of me not to look back over what has been overall a really interesting campaign. Maybe not for local sides, according to Radio General and Radio Halton, Warrington and Widnes. It's been a season largely to forget for both of those, although they did have their level of success in the qualifiers later on. But let's just run through what actually happened. In the regular season, so the first 23 games of Super League, Castleford topped the table with 40 points. Widnes were actually bottom of the table with 11 points. It was Warrington, Catalan and Lee, alongside Widnes in the bottom four, making up the top eight, along with Castleford, were Leeds, Hull, Salford, Wakefield, St Helens, Wigan and Huddersfield, who at one point were bottom of the table. The Super 8s then came along. Castleford finished top of the pile. Leeds, Hull and St Helens also made it through to the playoffs. In those playoffs, Castleford defeated St Helens in one of the best games of rugby league that I think I've seen in many years. Cass defeating Saints 23-22 in extra time. Then in the other semi-final, Leeds defeated Hull by 18-16. Everyone was fancying Castleford for the grand final, but Leeds played their trump card, won 24-6. I mentioned the qualifiers. Warrington and Widnes didn't have that many problems in getting themselves back into Super League. Warrington went unbeaten in their seven games to finish with all 14 points. Widnes finished with 10. Hull Kingston Rovers, who topped the championship table in the regular season, they got the 5 wins that they needed to propel them back into Super League, having spent the season in the championship, which set Lee and the Catalans Dragons on a crash course in the £1 million match. Now, in that £1 million match, for quite some time, it was nip and tuck. It was very, very close, and then Catalans got on top and ended up winning by 26-10 to relegate Lee Centurions, and I think that saved the bacon of Catalans Dragons, to be honest. The rest of the qualifiers, well, they were made up of London, who got 3 points, Featherstone, who got 3 points, and Halifax, who this time round couldn't win a point. It was a pretty good end of season though for Halifax, if you take away their form in the qualifiers, because over the last sort of 6 weeks of the regular season, they managed to fight their way up from mid-table in the championship to claim that fourth spot and the extra money that that ensues. Heading into the Championship Shield, we saw Oldham and Bradford relegated from the Championship, so they will start next season in League One. In the Championship Shield final, Toulouse, who had been in the top four of the Championship for much of the campaign, but only to slip up in the final few weeks thanks to the form of Halifax, they defeated Sheffield to win the Championship Shield by 44 points to 14. Heading into League One, and Toronto Wolfpack romped home to win promotion. In the other game, that ended up being a playoff fought out between Barrow and Whitehaven. A real close, tight tussle with Barrow winning by 10 points to 6. And then the only other thing to bring people up to date with is, of course, the Challenge Cup, and Hull winning it for a second year on the run, 18 points to 14 against Wigan. A remarkable achievement for Hull, fully deserving. Lee Radford should get the freedom of the city. But that is 2017, all done and dusted. It remains for me to say thank you very much for joining us over the course of the season here on The Final Hooter. I'm Dave Parkinson. My thanks go to Adrian Jackson, who would normally be alongside me, but hasn't been able to make it for the last couple of weeks. Do keep your eyes open on loverugbyleague.com for further news. And we'll be back with The Final Hooter in the new year.